Laura Walker, thank you so much for doing this and for inviting us and having this event. This is part of a Bennington Conversation series, which broadcasts interviews with leading intellectuals and social justice advocates. And not only do we do it for the Bennington community, but also for our WAMC listenership. And we're thrilled with that partnership. Mike Davis was introduced by Laura, and Mike, it is a great pleasure to have you here tonight. I thank you very much for being with us. What a delight.
My pleasure. Thank you.
As Laura mentioned, there's a lot to talk about, and I do want to get to the article, Trench Warfare, which is notes on the 2020 election. And I assume you're still collecting notes on the 2020 election. There's still a lot to unpack.
Yeah. 4 years from now, I expect we'll still be trying to analyze what happened.
And so just put that into perspective of how unusual that is versus another election.
Well, one of the traditions in American political history and analysis it's based on the idea, it's something called realignment theory. And that's the belief that you have long, fairly stationary periods, balance of power between two parties, and then upheavals in the economy or war, or because it's American history, race, lead to sometimes the formation of new parties, like the Republican Party in the 1850s, out of the wreckage of the Federalist Party, but lead to the redistribution of votes and electorates. And of course, 1932, the New Deal was seen as the arrival of an urban majority in politics and the sons and daughters of the immigrants of the turn of the century. So even though this is now a pretty old paradigm, it's still a temptation to political scientists and to some journalists to see things in terms of fundamental realignments. And you might have expected, given the exponential growth of COVID deaths, collapse in the economy, that this would be such a turning point, epical moment. I began my analysis from the fact that it simply wasn't, that clearly the Democrats, as they have in the last five elections, won the popular vote, but Biden's electoral vote majority was based on a very small number, 150,000, 200,000 votes, just as Trump's have been based on 77,000 votes or so in battleground states in the Great Lakes in the Midwest. In this case, of course, Georgia is as well. So why didn't what seemed to be an unprecedented crisis, a crisis that, you know, was compared by everybody to the Great Depression, didn't give birth to a fundamental realignment? Instead, although Biden did marginally better than Clinton in terms of, you know, electoral votes, the huge turnout produced something of a stalemate. I mean, Trump won 74 million votes. Who could have expected that? And the down ticket of this election was a disaster for the Democrats, only partially pulled out of the fire by the miracle of black voter turnout and popular mobilization in Georgia. But in Congress, for instance, the Democrats were counting on enlarging their 2018 House majority by 10, 15, even 20 votes. It was reduced by 9 or 10 votes. Because this is a census year, the composition of state legislatures is all important. There are only a handful of states, including my native California, that have nonpartisan commissions to reapportion votes, to draw congressional district boundaries. So it was all important to the Democrats, for instance, to take control of the Texas legislature. And they needed only 8 seats to do that and invested, you know, much money and effort in it and gained nothing.
And that, it's what's so fascinating, because in your writing about this, you refer to in the article, you refer to the Democratic victory as a hollow victory. And I'm curious as to what did you at any point, because look, we were told, polls told us that we were going to have a blue wave, that the Democrats were ready to take the Senate. The House was only going to be strengthened for Democrats. There would be obviously an overwhelming victory for Joe Biden. So when none of that happened, when none of that occurred, and up until the Georgia election, we didn't even know the balance of power in the Senate, which I will note is you wrote this piece prior to the Georgia election. What did happen? It is still. Who did something right and who screwed up, or is it both?
Well, it's both. On the Democratic side, the Democrats lost control over the issue of employment, jobs, and income, when they should have had totally controlled this issue from the start, arguing that a national plan for combating the pandemic was the basis for economic recovery and job growth. Trump started in April to divide the two issues with his campaign to put America back to work, which later grew into this grotesque advocacy of herd immunity. Economy, work at any price. Who cares about people in nursing homes. In October, the economic figures looked pretty impressive. It looked like a recovery was coming. Now, if you look at the opinion polls, really from Trump's inauguration until the end of October, there's somewhere between 38% and 41% voters polled are for Trump, you know, come hell or high water. These are the people he described at the very beginning in 2016. It's the people where he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue in New York and they'd vote for him anyway.
Right.
But the 74 million votes, this leaves somewhere between 18 to 22 million folks who voted for Trump that don't fit into that hardcore category, who are not ideologically Trump supporters. And I think the decisive thing that prevented the blue wave was the issue of jobs. Now, ordinary Americans have been forced into this Sophie's choice since the end of March. On one hand, of risking their health, or those of vulnerable members of their family. On the other hand, their need for work. The first big relief bill allayed that to some extent. But by the fall, this had become an absolute overriding issue. I think it also explains, for instance, why there's a small but still real increase in both male and female Black voters for Trump. And I think amongst lower income, low wage workers, this was an excruciating choice that had to be made, but they made it to keep the economy open. And the Democrats could have prevented that. They could have kept the issues totally alloyed to one another, but they didn't do it. And finally, if I may say this, look, the problem with the Democrats, and I mean with Obama, Clinton, and with Biden himself, despite his populist roots, is ultimately what this comes down to is you go to somebody's house in Dubuque, Iowa, or Youngstown, Camden, New Jersey. You sit down with a family on the dinner table. They got their bills stacked ahead of us. They live in a place which has suffered drastic job losses, drastic decline in opportunity. People in migrating out in some cases since the end of the 70s. And what people will ask you is this: what are you going to do concretely to increase job security in this community? What are you going to do to enable us to return to the income levels that we had enjoyed, you know, for many decades before that? Now, the Republicans, Trump has, of course, specious answers, fantastical answers. He promises that millions of jobs will, you know, quickly be repatriated. But he's able to talk about that in terms that the Democrats can't. If Joe Biden comes and sits down and says, look, we're going to create millions of jobs in green energy. Okay, the woman who's lost her job at the supermarket, the guy who's been laid off the locomotive, GE locomotive works in Erie, Pennsylvania, is going to say, what, you know, we're going to go out to Wyoming or somewhere and install solar panels and wind tower. How's this going to help this community? Because you have to speak not to individuals, but you have to speak to the communities themselves. And the Democrats have almost entirely been unable to do that. The exception, of course, was the Sanders campaign. And the Sanders campaign got an extraordinary resonance and support in these kinds of areas. And none of the other Democratic candidates, has enjoyed, because he was speaking to, you know, the concrete facts of people's community and local situations.
Mike Davis is our guest, Professor Emeritus at UC Riverside, and is the author of the recent essay, Trench Warfare, which appears in New Left Review. You just spoke, which I thought was an interesting timeline that you set out, of looking at the pandemic, which came upon us in February, and we started to see lockdowns in March. And then we heard, well, by Easter, you're going to be back. Everything's going to be back to normal. And that's when the shift came for the Trump administration, where the campaign got involved. And you were going, as you said, to herd immunity. But you also make the point that this is where militia groups got involved at about that same time, that there was also that interest. Which, so tell us how that played into what was happening in our politics that set us up for what we saw going into the campaign, and of course that culminated on January 6th.
Well, we know that from the end of January 2020, the pandemic finally got the president's attention because of Wall Street. February, the U.S. was in line to join other first responders like South Korea and so on in testing for the virus. The tests were flawed. They were contaminated. They still could have been used, but they weren't. And for an entire month, the CDC sat on its hands. And by the time that there was sufficient tests to begin to distribute them across the country, pandemic was going exponentially. It was out of control. So there's a total failure of containment. Then at the beginning of April, the first attempts at quarantines and selective closure. The economy, of course, started to go south in a most dramatic way. So what Trump did, and this isn't a matter of just Trump getting on his on his checks and messaging out to the, you know, the dark hinterland someplace. The Trump administration got the Tea Party movement and the groups which had orchestrated and ventriloquized that movement. It's a so-called people's movement. That is far-right institutes and political lobbies like FreedomWorks, for instance, or Tea Party Patriots. These were the infrastructure been created in 2010 against Obama, and they mobilized people, including the armed groups. Now, in some cases, like Michigan, where the same people who later stormed the U.S. Capitol appeared with guns in the state capitol, tried to break into the legislature, same thing in Wisconsin. They were supported by numbers of Republican legislatures. The idea that there is some kind of a fringe simply, you know, isn't true. They are broadly accepted by at least a minority. The Republican Party is legitimate. But more to the point was that this constellation of political action committees and right-wing institutes, again, like FreedomWorks, Tea Party, Patriots, and so on, which are heavily financed by far-right billionaires and have innumerable connections to sitting Republicans, they played the crucial organizational role here. They organized the protest in conjunction with the White House. And this, of course, grew from the demand to reopen the economy to a campaign against the elementary public safety measures advocated by one wing of the administration itself, by the CDC and Department of Health and Human Services, against masking, against social distancing. The president took every opportunity to hold rallies, you know, to show his contempt for these measures. I don't think, and then by the end of this summer, you had this spurious Dr. Alexander, not at all a specialist in epidemic diseases, was brought in basically to replace Tony Fauci as the spokesperson for the pandemic. And he advocated herd immunity, which in many ways is an almost Nazi like idea. Earlier, one of the Texas Republicans and made a big bravado point, macho point, of saying, well, he was prepared to take the risk and die if necessary to free the economy. And he was sure that many older people felt the same way. Those of us who are over 70, I can assure you, were not eager to volunteer. We would have liked to seen him volunteer. But this is what the administration was doing. And it amounts to a criminal conspiracy, criminal acts against the national and state level public health campaigns that was responsible for a large share of the deaths that have occurred. And I've advocated the need for a national commission, not just a small subcommittee under Representative Clyburn in the House that's looking at what went wrong in the pandemic, but a real investigative 9/11 type commission. It would explore not only, you know, what went wrong, what we need to do in the future, et cetera, but would look at the issue of liability and criminal responsibility in the response. But it appears that that idea has no purchase amongst the Democrats right now.
So then it seems to me then with that structure in place, And leading up to the election, we saw the switch. You mentioned the rallies and so forth, where, yes, it was still about COVID, and you won't hear that after Election Day and so forth. But then the shift came about, and we saw this starting with the changes to the Postal Service as to the election would be rigged. And then, of course, by the time the election came, it was rigged. And then that's the narrative. So these militia groups that you're talking about were already in place and ready to go, so that none of this all fit the narrative that they were setting, correct?
Yes, but the militia groups, again, are appendages to the broader grassroots movement, orchestrated and financed by Republican think tanks and political action committees. I mean, it's very ironic here, because in the 60s, or for that matter, you know, go back to the Depression itself, you know, the Democratic Party was buoyed up by and advanced the ideas and demands of popular movements in the streets and the factories and so on. But today, the Democrats focus simply on elections. We did not have a big movement, for instance, in solidarity with health workers in this country. We did not have demonstrations demanding the invocation of the Defense Production Act on a large enough scale to provide protective equipment to all essential workers and frontline speakers. The action in the streets was all on the other side. And in a sense, this is the this has been the new paradigm of the Republican Party. Some would say going back to Gingrich and the Clinton administration, but at least since the rise of the Tea Party and the tremendous victories it scored on local and state levels in the 2010 elections. This is not just a demagogic president on one hand and, you know, shadowy militia groups on the other. It's an organized grassroots, which acknowledges and regards the militia groups as legitimate allies and supporters of the president.
So when it comes to that organization, as you and I talk, we are in the second impeachment trial against this president of the United States, who has been charged with insurrection and inciting an insurrection at the United States Capitol. Is he guilty of that, in your opinion?
I would not call it insurrection. Maybe I'm just being a little bit...
What would you call it?
Too academic. Well, you know, destructive, violent riot. One of the purposes may have been to injure or murder Democratic members of Congress, to disrupt the vote. It was not a plan to take power. Of course, I would, you know, support the impeachment. But see, one of the, you know, problems in American history is when finally presidents using, you know, abusing executive privilege are brought to book, it's usually over an offense that's the minor offense. So Richard Nixon broke into the Democratic headquarters and his paranoia about the McGovern campaign. So that's what Watergate was about. It was not about the illegal bombing and war of Cambodia. It was not about Henry Kissinger's role in the coup that overthrew Allende. There are 1,000 different points of corruption in this past administration. And I fear these will be, once the impeachment is over, this may bring about a kind of informal settlement. Okay, we've done everything we could against this guy. We're not going to go back and investigate all the corruption and the distribution of funds through the stimulus packages that gave money to top-tier law firms, to payday, checking companies, all kinds of, you know, scurrilous people, all the conflicts of interest. This is why I'm very conscious and not a little alarmed that the impeachment could then lead to let's move on, as we did after Nixon. Let's not address the really even more serious stuff. Now, obviously, citing a crowd to disrupt Congress, take over the Capitol, is in some ways more serious than bugging the Democrats in Washington. But I think there are, you know, literally dozens of major crimes here that will be amnesty. The Democrats have this habit, you know, of always, you know, shaking hands and agreeing to forget what their, you know, opponents have just done. I mean, Obama almost immediately, and probably even before his inauguration and negotiations with the Bush White House, you know, decided not to investigate torture in Iran or the, you know, lies and deliberate misconceptions that were used to foment a terrible war. And I fear we may go down the same path again. What Congress needs right now is a Democrat in the mold of some of the old congressional crusaders like Wright Patman or Henry Gonzalez, okay? Mm-hmm. That were real pit bulls when it came to corruption and the role of big business in congressional politics. In other words, who wouldn't let go of these issues, that continued the investigation, continued to insist on the need for indictments to bring people to book. I don't know if such a figure exists in the current Congress or not.
Do you see hope there in the case of even young lawmakers who are coming along who have those skills and perhaps to develop that power?
Well, one would hope so. But the first thing that the Democrats have to learn is the importance of protest outside capitals, national and state, the importance of of the street. Now, the Sanders campaign was built on the proposition that you could do two things at once, that you could be inside and outside, mm-hmm. that struggles over, for instance, Black Lives Matter or to defend unions and so on, anti-war protests, you know, would help support the electoral campaign. The electoral campaign and the people elected to office would then help make these movements ongoing and to stimulate more activity. That, as I think some cynical veterans of prior movements would have expected, didn't happen. I mean, Bernie Sanders, after his concession, I mean, I'm a, you know, like everybody else in my extended family, as Sanders contributed, and get these wonderful messages, you know, great idea for a bill, the importance of this piece of legislation, why we have to fight like hell. And then the message always ended is send $23 to this person or that, not go out in the streets, not protest. And the pivotal moment here, the crucial moment, was also in April, as Trump was beginning to actively sabotage public health measures, was when you had this series of sometimes official, but mainly rank and file actions, workers demanding safer conditions. You know, nurses, grocery workers, people trying to organize in Amazon. In New England, I think it was actually the carpenters who went out on strike because of this. And although people like Bernie Sanders, you know, supported them, they did nothing really to actively organize that support or create a broader movement. Now, a lot of people would say, well, what do you expect? I mean, you know, we're not, people aren't idiots like on the other side are going to go out in the street en masse. They really had no choice. You really had to stay at home. I argued from March onward that that wasn't really true. That, you know, is perfectly possible to demonstrate and, you know, an organized protest if you follow the elementary precautions prescribed by public health officials. And in fact, Black Lives Matter demonstrations did that. You know, there were large demonstrations through the beginning of the summer, and none of them turned into the super spreader events equivalent to what happened at Trump rallies or pro-Trump protests.
So my final question before I turn it back to President Walker, where do you think is where do you think we're headed here as we look to this new administration that is just a few weeks into its first 100 days, and they're tap dancing trying to not fall into the trap of getting too involved in what happened and moving ahead and trying to get us out of a pandemic. So that tightrope walk, how do you think that is going? How do you think that will go as this administration looks to, yes, to make this country safer as in eradicating a pandemic and also trying to equal the scales economically, and oh, by the way, maybe even try to save the climate as well?
Well, my fear is that under the banner of restoring the economy and decency and getting ordinary Americans back on their feet, we'll totally lose sight of the structural reforms, the constitutional and governmental reforms that at one point there was really quite vigorous, dramatic national discussion about the Electoral College, you know, statehood for D.C., the reform of presidential powers, because what we've seen in the last several years is that the Constitution, it's a bit like DNA. DNA, you know, has areas that are genes, then it has huge stretches where the nucleic acids don't seem to code for anything. In fact, most of the DNA is, is full of that. And we've discovered the Constitution's a bit like that too. What is unspecified, unauthorized, you know, undefined, leaves frighteningly large room for abuse of power and for the growth of the self-development of autocracy from the White House. I don't see that being a big issue at the moment. Maybe you say, well, that has to wait. But that's what always happens. We postpone these crucial reforms because they're always immediate crises. They're always bread and butter issues to be solved. I fear that although Biden has been more progressive in his executive actions than most people who call themselves progressive probably had expected. You know, that's very true. But if you look at the actions individually, he tends to pull punches, okay? He tends not to make truly radical and necessary changes. So, for instance, we're going to get the Department of Justice out of the business of using private contractors in prisons and so on. That's only about 8 or 9%. But his executive action didn't say anything about homeland security, where 75% of detention centers are privately managed. That wasn't discussed. I know this sounds like nitpicking at a time when everything is moving so fast and the stakes couldn't be higher. But someone needs to remember what we were talking about 6 months ago or a year ago, where we were talking about even simply in December, after the sabotage stolen election campaign was in full blast, the necessary kinds of reforms. And so, you know, we'll see if progressives try and maintain that agenda and push the other Democrats in Congress to continue investigations. And for me, the acid test here is Medicare for all. Now, 70% of Americans completely supported. The pandemic accentuated its necessity and urgency, you know, beyond, you know, any shadow of a doubt. But unfortunately, the people who negotiated from the Sanders camp with the Biden camp back in March, or maybe it was April, about the Democratic platform, conceded that point for the moment. You know, are we really going to address the failures of healthcare in America that we now all should understand pretty well in the wake of the pandemic? Or is everything going to be simply focused on vaccine distribution and the kind of reforms to enable us to recover from this pandemic, although we live in an age of pandemics, right, and more are almost certainly coming? And to do that, we have to fix, you know, the grassroots of our healthcare system. We have to eliminate the role of private health insurance. But I just see the possibility of so many things falling off the plate for the White House and for majority of Democrats, unless there aren't very loud and, you know, radical voices, you know, continuing to make the case for, you know, as Elizabeth Warren called it, truly radical reform.
Mike Davis is professor emeritus at UC Riverside. His recent essay, Trench Warfare, is in New Left Review. Mike Davis, what a great pleasure. Thank you so much for conversing with us. I greatly appreciate your insights.
It's been an honor. Thank you.